Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 7th of June 2015. My name's TLP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Paul in London, Webcow Girl, Gareth James, and Phil from the West End Winchers. We're now going to talk about High Society at the Old Vic. This started out as a film, really almost a confection put together to highlight the talents of Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra and Grace Kelly, using Cole Porter songs. I mean, Cole Porter wrote quite a few songs for this, but they imported one or two songs. I seem to recall that the song Well Did You Ever is taken from a much earlier musical and just imported in so that Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra can have a duet together, which, of course, they wouldn't have normally had in the play or the musical, because High Society, of course, is based on the play The Philadelphia Story, which about 10 years before the film had a very famous production with Cary Grant, James Stewart and Katharine Hepburn. Now, all this brings us around to the fact that this musical is being run at the Old Vic, which 10 years ago now hosted The Philadelphia Story, starring Kevin Spacey and Jennifer Ely. That production was, I don't think they quite got the chemistry right on that, and I think it is a very important thing to really get the chemistry right with that particular play, and I'm not sure they did. The High Society here at the Old Vic seems to have got much better reviews, and stars Kate Fleetwood as Tracy Lord, with Jamie Parker as Mike, Annabelle Scully as Celia, and Rupert Young as C.K. Dexter Haven. It's directed by West End star Maria Friedman, and the book was by Arthur Coppett. We've got additional lyrics by Susan Birkenhead. The musical was adapted, I think we're talking, this version is the 1998 adaptation of the film, which they are reviving, although I think there have been earlier attempts to do it. Paul, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Yes, well, I think, as you mentioned, this version seems to be better received. I guess, you know, everyone loves a swell party and, you know, there's Cole Porter songs, admittedly, though, perhaps not his most memorable songs when you think of the entire collection. But, you know, there is Well Did You Ever? And then there's also Let's Misbehave, which has been added to this piece. So, you know, when you leave the theatre thinking, you know, there's some great music in this. I think the difficulty with this piece, which I felt, and I must stress that I did see it at a very early preview, so things may have gotten a bit better as it went along, was that I felt that the casting seemed to favour actors over singers. And this affected my enjoyment of this on the basis that these songs really about completely over the top emotions that should transport you into another world. And the actors, that grounded it too much in sort of a gritty realism for me, that actually leaving the piece, I thought it wasn't bad and there's a lot to like about it, but I didn't quite buy the relationships, and particularly the interrelationship between Kate Fleetwood and Rupert Young. I just didn't understand that. You know, you couldn't understand that there was a history between the two. And it had actually, sitting there watching the piece, did have me thinking about how Katharine Hepburn and Jimmy Stewart interrelated, Cary Grant interrelated in the original piece that it was based on, much more so than even thinking about the movie. So there was a mixed bag for me, I think. But, you know, there's a lot to take in. It's staged in the round, so it's quite sparse, but still manages to be quite visually spectacular. Things pop out of from the stage, or, you know, come down from above. And while the staging is quite simple, it's quite an impressive effect that they managed to make with the piece. The other thing is that the piece starts with Joe Stilgo at the piano taking requests from the audience. Now, if you've actually not seen this before, it is quite funny because usually the audience throws out the most improbable tunes. I think he was asked to perform the theme from Jaws and Indiana Jones along with something from Rachmaninoff. And he sort of merges it all together in a piece which serves to be a bit of a warm-up for the first half. which actually was quite welcome, given that the first half of this piece seems to be a bit slow and sluggish. And I'm not sure why. I think perhaps best numbers are really in the second half. There's a lot of exposition to get through in the first half as well. And so the first half for me dragged a bit more than the second half. The second half has an incredible dance spectacular where dual pianos appear. And, you know, people are dancing on top of pianos. People are dancing all around the whole theater. And it had the audience cheering at that point. And that was an extended version of Anything Goes. Not Anything Goes. It's so easy to confuse all the Cole Porter musicals. They seem to run into one actually after a while. But I think it's quite an enjoyable production, but perhaps not the best production of it. And perhaps that's due to the casting, and perhaps it's probably also due to, you know, the limitations of the material being based on a film which was then sort of turned into a musical in the late 90s.
One of the things that I always think about the Philadelphia Story, I mean, quite a lot of that early exposition stuff is held together by the sort of the charm of your Diana, your Dinah Lord. This Ellie Bamba, I mean, was it that kind of sparky performance? I can't remember the film version of High Society, how much prominence she gets, because I think it is more about the main three or the main four.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because for me, I thought that was a bit off, and I don't know whether that the night I saw it was because it was just an early preview and there was a lot of nerves and things that they hadn't yet bedded down. But it didn't seem like there wasn't enough, I think, comic interplay, and I thought that it seemed more grounded in sort of realism rather than sort of treating the whole piece as it was quite a silly story and that actually anything could happen in it.
I mean, we should point out that what Joe Stilgo is doing, any relation to Richard?
Yes, I think that's Richard is his father.
Oh, right, okay. But Joe Stilgo is presumably playing the part that was Louis Armstrong's in the film, or similar, because of course there is this sort of jazz band in the film.
Yes,
which is sort
talented
of
musician
it.
That is thrown all sorts of things to do, yes. So he sort of appears on the periphery to the actual story, pretty much probably like Louis Armstrong was treated in the film. But yes, I think the other thing too was, for me, I thought some of the casting of some of the other minor characters didn't quite make sense. So Tracy Lord's father, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Christopher Ravenscroft.
Yeah, and also Uncle Willie, who was played by Jeff Rawl. I think the performances were a little bit too ripe, I thought, not quite comedic enough for the piece, and almost felt like they were in a different play. But I think overall, I think you could either be picked up and taken along with these Cole Porter tunes. You know, it's a wonderful little production. Well, not so little. It's a wonderful production, and there's a lot to take in, but it was a little bit too realistic and grounded, I think, the night I saw it, rather than to be some fanciful, frothy piece. But having said that, I think Maria Friedman, who seems to be getting a habit of directing challenging musicals, I think, having previously done Merrily We Roll Along, has made some good choices here in terms of the material. I think the choice probably to cast actors over, you know, people that, you know, was a really strong sort of Broadway style singers is a weakness in it, but you know, you can respect the choices that she's made, and actually the production itself overall comes across as quite nice. Just it didn't sparkle, I suppose.
The only thing I would add is, of course, that Annabelle Scully plays Liz Imbri, and I call her Celia for reasons that might occur to people. We're now going to talk about The Clockmaker's Daughter, which is on at the Landor Theatre with a tremendously large cast by the look of it. Webcow Girl, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Okay. The Clockmaker's Daughter is a modern fairy tale and a new musical. Fortunately, as a fairy tale, it is not modern. It is set in sort of an imaginary era, say around 1880, but you know, a little bit sort of fairy tale time, but it is pre-industrial And it is a world in which people make a living by making clocks and by sewing. And it's also set in, it claims to be in a sort of imaginary town in Ireland, which I suppose is necessary because British castes seem to be a bit lost if you don't give them some kind of accent specificity. However, it's not actually important in the story. The idea of the story is that a clockmaker, Abraham, has lost his wife and wants a companion. So in the grand tradition of plays like myths like Pygmalion or fairy tales like Coppelia, he makes himself one out of, I suppose, bits and bobs and gears on things that are laying around his shop. And this is Constance, who will always be there with him. And she's played by Jennifer Harding. Abraham, the clockmaker, is played by Lawrence Carmichael. It's a little unclear at the beginning if she's a replacement for the wife, but there doesn't seem to be any sort of romance or anything else going on. And so she is his daughter. But in the tradition of robots throughout fairy tale land, she begins to have a personality of her own and a desire to do her own things. And what she wants to do is she wants to get out of his house and go into the village. Unfortunately, she winds up crossing paths with the village seamstress, a woman named Ma Riley, played by Jo Wickham. And the way that she crosses paths is by taking something that Ma Riley has just sewn up and inadvertently knocking it into a well. So she knocks a wedding dress into a well, causing a bit of a problem for the bride-to-be and perhaps a business opportunity for Ma Riley, who's going to have to redo this dress in its entirety. The way that Constance handles this, done off stage, is she essentially sews up a new dress overnight. And her speed and her fashion sense lead to her becoming more popular as a seamstress than Ma Riley is. And this means that she has made an enemy, because while Constance has Abraham to, you know, take care of her, I suppose she mostly just needs winding up, Ma Riley actually needs to sell dresses. And if she's got competition who's better and who's making dresses for free, this is putting a real crimp, as it were, in her business. So Ma has got it in for Constance. Meanwhile, Ma's son, Will, has it sort of for Constance because he's fallen in love with her. So the conflict is that her father wants her not to be out in the village and certainly not be out there meeting people and causing trouble. And he predicts that this is going to make people hate her when they discover that she isn't real. So that's probably enough to say about the plot. It does sort of go in a bit of a Frankenstein-esque direction, but the whole thing ultimately has a message of tolerance for the difference, the different, which I thought was, you know, fairly appropriate for a modern fairy tale. I can promise you that outside of Hans Christian Andersen, there's not a fairy tale out there in which being different is particularly seen as something to be treasured. You can be the seventh son of a seventh son, or you can be the youngest daughter. But actually, if you're a robot in fairy tale land, things usually don't go so well for you. The songs are definitely, it's a really big show for the lander with its huge cast, but also an extremely, I thought, elaborate set, which makes use both of projections done rather nicely and all sorts of beautiful paintings and sculptures that look like gears, so that we're nicely transported from the workshop of Abraham to the town square to Ma Riley's seamstress shop and to my favorite location, which is a rooftop. The songs are, I thought, like, enjoyable and more tuneful than a lot of modern musical productions were, and nice to hear sung, but I didn't actually find them particularly memorable or moving, but still it had a very good feel to it. I think overall as a show, what we're probably actually seeing is a draft of a future Clockmaker's Daughter, and one in which the sort of strange tension between Constance and Abraham, because it is a little bit unclear what their relationship might be, is clarified to be, you know, more clearly he's the father and she is the daughter. But you get a very wonderful feeling of Constance as a creature like Pinocchio, who wants to be a person. She wants to be loved. She wants to be real. She wants to be accepted. And I thought Constance's aspirations were very much touching the heartstrings. You could empathize with her easily. And the romance that sprouts up between her and Will, I think, is very nice. And the way that he manages finding out what she's really made of is really quite interesting. I think it was a good effort, not quite there, but for £20 to listen all of those people singing in the close confines of the Lander, it did have very much a magical feel to it. Gareth, what do you think?
I think I'm probably a bit more positive than you about it. I mean, it's very rare to get modern musicals on this scale, because the vast majority of modern musicals are kind of chamber pieces, really. And in particular, you don't really get, well, you don't get 20 people and you don't get a chorus that big. And I think what Michael Webern's show has done is actually sort of given us a peek of what you can do, really, with a modern musical. And I think the standout part of the show for me is the score. I think it's a very, very melodic score. And I think in particular, I found the choruses absolutely uplifting. You know, 20 people singing their hearts out on the Landor stage almost raises the roof. And the orchestration was lovely, with piano, double bass, violin and percussion. Not drums, but percussion. So I think it's musically very strong. I'm not an adult fairy tale fan, to be honest. So the material isn't necessarily something I would go for, but I thought it was, you know, it was a perfectly good story. And I agree with you that, you know, the moral, the underlying moral of Vive la Difference, as it were, I think is a nice touch. I also liked the fact that it was framed by scenes today, sort of looking back. I thought that gave it a kind of quite a pleasing structure, really. So I you mentioned the design. I think the design is, you know, for a fringe theatre is exceptional. And I really like the projections and the lighting as well. So I think David Shields and Richard Lambert have done a cracking job on that. There's a fireplace in the Lander, an actual fireplace, brilliantly integrated into the set for this show. And the clock theme is beautifully represented, as you hinted at in the rooftop scene, but also a clock face behind as well, or part of a clock face behind, which reminded me a bit of the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. So I think it's, as you say, it's a first outing, and I suspect we will see it again, because I think it's too good for us not to see it again. And I'm sure it will grow and get better. But I thought it was particularly strong musically, and that's the standout for me. But from a performance point of view, the two that sort of caught my eye, really, were Alan McHale, who plays Will, the sort of dressmaker's son and love interest for Constance, and then a nice little cameo performance from Max Abraham in a smaller role as Sam. I think those are the two that sort of captured me. So, I mean, you know, for fringe musicals, I think this is absolutely something that you have to go and see. I mean, it's of a very high standards. It's performed extremely well by a fairly young ensemble. So I think it's a must. It's a must for musical theatre people.
It's not really fair for me to compare it to Gypsy, you know.
Thanks.
But I'm always hoping to walk out singing songs.
The thing about new musicals is you are going in cold, and it is very hard, you know, to hear a score for the first time, I think. And even if you haven't listened to a score, if it's a revival musical like Gypsy, some of the songs are bound to be sort of in your head there. So I think the starting point is so much better when, you know, when something is more known. So I think new musicals do have to fight a bit. I remember going to see the very first production of Follies, and the friend who I went with, or one of the two friends I went with, came out saying, Yeah, but there aren't any tunes you remember, are there? And here we are, 20, 30 years later, where the tunes and follies are completely iconic. So I think a first hearing is often very difficult for a new musical, really.
So
this is Michael Webborn's first proper musical, I think. He's basically a musical director, and he's been the musical director of Landor in a half a dozen shows, and he's a very, very good musical director. And you know, this is, I think, his first musical. And if you put that, you know, if you put it in that kind of context, wow.
I could really see that on a big stage.
Yeah.
But really, the thing you have to do, and you're right about it being a must for musical theater fans, you're never going to see it that small, that close again.
No.
So.
I think that's, for me, the sort of the choruses, and there are quite a lot of them. I mean, that is a real treat, seeing, you know, because they're not just well sung, they're well staged. I think that the choruses are, the choruses made the evening for me.
We're now going to talk about The Father, which is on at the Tricycle Theatre. This is a co-production with the Theatre Royal Bath, and when it was at the Theatre Royal Bath last year, it garnered a large number of very, very positive reviews. In fact, Lynn Gardiner of The Guardian said it was her top theatre show of 2014. It's by the French writer Florian Zeller, and it's been translated by Christopher Hampton, is directed by James MacDonald, and stars Kenneth Cranham as the titular father and Claire Skinner as his daughter, together with Colin Tierney, Jim Sturgeon, Rebecca Charles and Jade Williams. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, it's a play about dementia. As soon as you say that, you know, that people sort of think, gosh, that must be depressing. And in some ways it is. I mean, you know, as you get older, I think one of the things you fear most is something like dementia, probably more than any physical condition. But it's also very insightful. And it's nowhere near as heavy as you would expect a play about dementia to be. And what's so clever about the play for me is that effectively he messes with your head. And that kind of is how you get to peep inside the head of a dementia sufferer, really. And you do feel as if you understand more about what it must be like to experience this condition. And it starts very straightforwardly, but it soon becomes quite disorientating. And then things change, characters change. It's quite difficult to describe, really. But if we just take his daughter, played by Claire Skinner, you know, she may or may not have a husband. She may or may not be moving to London. She may or may not have a sister. So there are all sorts of layers to it that are confusing. And of course, which it kind of echoes the confusion of the father who's the dementia sufferer. So our confusions or parallels his confusion, and that's, I think, how we sort of begin to understand the predicament and indeed dread the predicament. It's a series of very short, very sharp scenes, and you know, we see his condition deteriorate in this way, and the characters and their backstories change, the room changes. He is moving from his own flat to his daughter's flat to a home in the space of the play. But that notwithstanding, there are also changes to the scenery that are just part of the disorientation, I guess. And the final scene when he is now in a rest home is just simply devastating. It is, I think, beautifully written and translated. I really think it's a very good piece of work. It's only 90 minutes long, but every moment of it contributes to the story. And I just felt in 90 minutes, I just felt it's extraordinary how much I felt I kind of understood about dementia, and because there is humor in there, as well as the sadness and the frustration and everything else, that kind of lightens the tone. It doesn't disrespect the subject, but it lightens the tone. And therefore, I didn't sort of leave the theater feeling particularly depressed, despite the fact it's a play about dementia. James MacDonald's directed very sympathetically, because given that subject matter, that's really quite important. And all of the performances are very good. But Kenneth Cranham, you know, navigates this decline so delicately and so movingly. I mean, I haven't seen Kenneth Cranham that many times, but this is unquestionably, you know, his finest moments in the times I have seen him. And Claire Skinner, I think, her performance is very nuanced as Anne, because, you know, she has to be both full of love for her father, but also struggling to balance the demands of caring with a need to live her own life and the frustrations that kind of brings, really. So I thought overall this was a subject we rarely speak of that's kind of handled very thoughtfully and it's very illuminating. And I think it's the sort of thing only theatre can do, really. And I think it is a very powerful piece of theatre. I think I wouldn't necessarily put it in my best of the year that Lynn Gardiner did, but I certainly think it's an exceptional piece of theatre.
and absolutely worth visiting the Tricycle for if there are any tickets left.
It was a disturbing play. I mean, it was when you got to the idea when they start, they depict the dementia, but of course by removing furniture and changing things around. And he gets very confused. Oddly enough, I think somebody else has seen this play because there's an advert that does this about dementia that does a similar thing where a man is on his own, although initially he's surrounded by people, but every time it cuts, there are fewer people and he's more and more alone. And so it's odd that should come up. It does seem to be a very true portrait of the way that you do dementia. I mean, I don't know that I've had too many dementia sufferers in my family. It's the anger as much as anything else, the anger that you know you're forgetting, the frustration that you're not, that you're not all there, and it can make you very, very angry at the world and angry at yourself for knowing that you're failing, because you have those moments of lucidity when you realize that it's not, you know, you're not all there, and it's scary and really terrifying at the times. And I think this depicts that transition very well with Kenneth Branagh in the role. He does bring this idea that it's all failing, and he kind of knows he's failing, but he doesn't really want to admit it. And it's a lovely performance by him, and of course by Claire Skinner. I think the other actors, I mean, I do like to mention Colin Tierney, because it's always interesting to see Colin Tierney in anything, but it is really their play, I think, and it's a discovery. I mean, it has to be said that the Theatre Royal Bath do seem to be pushing out some rather good stuff. I think they must have a good artistic team there.
And it comes from a studio which is putting on a lot of things that are getting a lot of attention now. This is not the first thing we've had up from Bath. I remember Intimate Apparel up at the Park Theatre came from the studio in Bath as well, and I thought that was an exceptional piece. And both of those have been, not translations, because the other one was American, but have sort of been plays from other countries that have had their first outing in Britain at Bath.
We're now going to talk about The Elephant Man at the Theatre Royal Haymarket. This is, well, it's largely a Broadway import. It stars Bradley Cooper, Patricia Clarkson and Alessandro Nivola. It's directed by Scott Ellis, and it is a production of Bernard Pomerantz's play from, well, it must be much more than 30 years ago, because it is the play that inspired the much more famous film, I believe, the black and white film made by David Lynch, produced by Mel Brooks, and starring Anthony Hopkins and John Hurt. It has been on more recently in London, this play. It was on at the Trafalgar Studios about 8 years ago. It wasn't particularly well reviewed at the time, although they did like Mark Pickering as Merrick in that production. Phil, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, just one thing. I don't know whether did inspire the film, because the film was 1980 and presumably would have been in production for a while, and the play was 1979, which is when I saw it with David Schofield, who was absolutely incredible as Merrick. And in those days, well, certainly in that production, he played it naked, which Bradley Cooper, who's starring in this production, certainly doesn't. Otherwise, they'd probably be charging even more than £108 for their premium seats. I mean, everybody's mentioned it, but I think it is worth mentioning the fact that there is an irony in the fact that everybody's coming to gawp at Bradley Cooper, just as, you know, people used to come and gawp at the Elephant Man. So he's kind of the side show attraction here. And the one thing I think that is good about this production is him, particularly when you first see him, and Frederick Treves, the surgeon who sort of befriends him and looks after him, explains the different conditions, showing real slides of Merrick as he was. And Cooper gradually contorts his body and his face into the different positions. And then he is done without prosthetics, unlike the film. So he just sort of assumes the role throughout. And I think he does that pretty well, even though I did have a bit of a problem because his voice reminded me of David Walliams. And once I got that in my head, I couldn't really shake it off. But as a play itself, I think it's pretty weak. And given it's an hour and 50 minutes, and I think there's a big mistake by putting an interval in, but presumably because the show is almost selling out, there's a lot of money to be made at the bars. But it does sort of interrupt the action. If they'd done it an hour and a half straight through, I think it might be better. But even at an hour and a half, it still, I think, it creaks. And there's quite a few longueurs in it. I actually found some parts of the play quite boring. And I did have a problem with most of the other people in it. Patricia Clarke's an actress I really, really like. And she does play the part well, but when I saw it, she was speaking far too quietly. And although you could hear her, you were really straining to hear her. I mean, because she was giving such a sort of subtle performance, I thought she needed to project much more. And Alessandro Nivola, well, I just thought his performance was all over the place. I find it quite incredible that he's been nominated for a Tony, which a tonight. In fact, all three leads have been nominated for Tonys, and I don't think they're going to win any of them. I think Bradley Cooper's perhaps in with a shot, but as a production, I don't think it deserves anything. A lot of the supporting players had very dodgy English accents, and gave, I thought, one particularly, which I'm not mentioning. I can't mention by name because I didn't buy a programme, because it's not really a programme, it's a souvenir brochure at £10, which I think is just, you know, having a laugh, really. I didn't really like this at all. I thought the whole thing was underpowered. It felt scrappy. I mean, it's played out on a nearly bare stage with just sort of curtains being constantly swished across, which I got to the point where that became irritating. And it gets a standing ovation at the end, probably because there's a lot of Americans in and they paid a lot of money to see Bradley Cooper. But I'm sorry, that wasn't enough for me. And I think it's kind of quite a worrying trend that seat prices are going up to this amount of money. And it's not just premium seating. I mean, it's most of the stalls are £108. I didn't sit in the stalls, needless to say, but I think it's really, really overpriced for what it is. But then if people are prepared to pay it, which they obviously are, I mean, there were a few empty seats the night we went, but not many. So, you know, and there's no offers on it, so it's making a lot of money.
Gath, what did you think?
It's clearly a commercial venture. I mean, the ticket prices, as Phil says, are just obscene, and the whole of the stalls is virtually premium price now. Programs are £10, and the interval is, I'm sure, just for bar profits, because it's completely unnecessary. So that kind of turns me against it before I've even arrived, really. But then again, I still went and I still paid. I actually thought Bradley Cooper was very good. I thought it was a very good performance, although I think his accent is too posh for somebody that is meant to be East London, I think. But I thought as a physical performance, I thought it was good. But to put it into perspective, you know, I saw three other performances that were just as good in the same week. And that was Shuala Ejiofor and Angus Wright and Kenneth Branagh. So, you know, it's good, but not life-changing. The other performances are okay. I thought Alexander, whatever his name was better than Phil did. And I thought Patricia Clarkson, apart from the fact she was one of the accents that was all over the place, was also quite good. But I can't name anybody else again because I refuse to pay for the programme. It is the weakness of the play, I think, that's at the core of it. And I think adding the interval weakens the play as well. I did see the first Broadway outing. This is my bit of name dropping now, which featured David Bowie. And my recollection, albeit from 35 years ago, was that it was a better play. But, you know, I think things have moved on. And the sort of minimalist staging and minimalist acting and without the prosthetics and the, and, you know, they're not so groundbreaking now. You know, we've seen a lot of this. And we're used to the kind of less naturalistic, more than we perhaps were then. So it hasn't, for me, passed the test of time, really. And I think that, whilst I regret going, but I just felt, you know, it was just another night in the theatre and nothing particularly special, really. And it was, you know, for me, clearly just a star vehicle after all. And all the Bradley Cooper fans in the audience who gave him the standing ovation clearly, you know, had what they wanted. So it did sort of commercially deliver what it set out to deliver. But for me, it was just another night in the theatre with a good central performance.
One thing I want to clear up, I thought Patricia Clarkson was playing an American actress because she didn't seem to be making an attempt at English accent at all, but other people seem to think that she was playing English, so I wasn't sure. And I assume that's the part that Anne Bancroft played in the film, and I can't remember whether she played it as American or not, but does anybody know?
Well, I thought it was meant to be a British actress. I thought she was part of British society, and I'm fine.
Well, that was lost on me. I put her down as an American actress because she didn't seem to be attempting to do English at all.
Well, her accent changed quite a lot during that.
Right, okay.
So there certainly were moments when she was clearly trying to be a British actress, but it failed. I think the person whose accent was most solid actually was Alessandro Nivola. I think he was the one who didn't waver as much for me.
I was mildly disappointed by this, if only because it is, as everyone said, it is this sort of money-making spectacular. It's not really that good, I think. I mean, I was more impressed by Alessandro Nivola than most people, and Bradley Cooper, of course, was, I think, very good. I did have a slight problem with Patricia Clarkson. I thought she was a little bit knowing right when she first came on. There was a little bit of, hey, look at me, I'm on stage. And I couldn't really get past that, although she was very good in some of the later scenes. There's a particular scene where she offends the doctor while trying to help the Elephant Man, which is really quite powerful and really rather well done. But yeah, I seem to remember being more impressed by the one I saw 8 years ago than this, the version of this play. So maybe it needed the smaller space, because that one was done at the Trafalgar Studios in the small space, and it's perhaps doesn't need all the weight of all the stars and of the expectation. I don't think the play really bears up under that. But of course, if it used to have David Bowie in it, then it probably has had that fuss before. But I don't think it entirely worked. But it doesn't. I don't think it really matters, because people are going for other reasons.
I think there were several in the original Broadway production. Bowie wasn't the first, by the way. It was somebody else. Bowie was the second or third, John Merrick. So I think they did use it in Broadway. And in fact, it was Bowie's real proper stage debut, and he was incidentally very, very good. But I think they used it in 1979. /80 as a bit of a star vehicle in the same way as they're doing it now.
I did actually think that the best scenes for me were the ones between Patricia Clarkson and Merrick and Cooper. I mean, those actually were quite effective, despite the fact straining to hear what she was saying. But other scenes, I didn't feel it didn't really, really create the atmosphere of sort of Victorian days, particularly for me. And I came away feeling I hadn't really seen a play for some reason. I felt I'd seen an event rather than anything, which obviously is the Cooper presence, but it was rather strange, I thought.
I mean, as a play, it is very slight. I mean, it doesn't really have that much depth. It doesn't sort of, it's not revealing in any way about the condition and Victorian society. I mean, it isn't a great play. And I don't think without a star in it, you'd probably revive it, to be honest.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page at Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.